You're listening to The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, bringing class to trash since 1977.
All right, everybody, welcome to the Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, episode 665. So close to the man's number, 666, which will be next week. But yes, we are back, and we're going to talk some classic cinema this week. We're going to talk a little Sam Fuller. We haven't done a whole lot of Sam Fuller on the show that I'm aware of. I feel like we've done a couple, or maybe one.
At least one, and he's come up. Obviously, he's come up a few times in the show. We never did Shock Corridor, I don't think, did we?
No. I don't think we've ever done that one. Pretty sure we've never done that one. Oh, sorry. Here I am, not prepared and playing noises over the damn speakers. Sorry for those who are listening. I'm looking to see if we've done any Sam Fuller.
I feel like we did at least one.
And I'm okay. Yeah. Well, no, I'm not seeing any.
Really.
I'm not seeing any. So this might be the first one.
Took us 15 plus years to get to Mr. Fuller.
Which is crazy.
It is. It is. We've probably done some less celebrated directors multiple times.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. Maybe I'm missing one. I don't know. Maybe there's some historians out there. Obviously, I don't keep a good history of our show. A little behind the scenes, we're always trying to figure out what we've covered and what we haven't. So
we're at that point in life, like age-wise and show-wise, where you know, to pull back the curtain, there's a couple of times I've gone to pick something and it's like, oh, we did that. I'm like, oh, this would be amazing to talk about.
Yeah. Well, in fairness to you, though, you were gone for a little while. And yeah. There are times when we've missed shows and we just kind of forget, I think, too. So it's a combination of things. But, you know, this is like the 1260th. I think it's 1261 film we've talked about on this show collectively. Either you, me, or someone else. And yeah. So it's easy to lose track, even though there's still hundreds of thousands to go.
Oh man, there definitely is.
If you want to be a completist, which I don't think we'll cover everything in our history. It's not feasible, to be honest, but,
No.
Just no way. I mean, 15 years, we've only done 1,200. So you give another 15 years.
Barely a drop in the bucket.
Yeah. So we got to, you know, you just got to pick what you got to pick and go with it. But yeah, that's what we're doing this week. 40 Guns, Sam Fuller film, 1957. Just kind of wanted to do an old Western. Hadn't done one in a while. Always like to kind of go back and look at those sometimes. And why not? This one looked like... one that I think would have some interesting conversation, a little ahead of its time in some ways.
Definitely was.
As Sam Fuller could be at times. Let's see. I got, is there anything you want to talk about here in the open before? We got a little bit of feedback, some emails. Walt, I got a voicemail. I'm going to save it for next week because our friend Jose likes your voicemails and he's going to be on our show next week with us. And so I'm going to save it. I'm just going to be honest and forthright right now, but I do got some emails I can read off, Will, if you don't have anything.
Nothing overly. We had talked, of course, behind the scenes about promoting some friends of ours that have a new show they've gotten off the ground. But I think, is this, you're going to do this now or you're going to?
Yeah, I mean, we can do it right now if you want to. Yeah. Good friend, Rob. I don't know if I've talked. I think I have spoken with Rob before. I'm not 100% positive. But him and his friend Joe have just dropped their first episode of a podcast called Caliber 9 from Outer Space. Good name. Good title. I like it. It pretty much kind of tells you what kind of podcast it is right there in the title. So it involves them reviewing, discussing cult exploitation movie double features every episode, starting with the two films which inspired the name. So I'm assuming that would be Milano Caliber number 9 and Plan 9 from Outer Space. Right? That would be right. Yeah,
that's exactly those the two. And that's a funny double, man. That's the kind of double. I mean, who'd have thought they'd see Ed Wood and Fernando De Leo on the same double? But that's what lovers of sort of the wide, wonderful world of film do, right?
We
double things up, and here you go.
So he wrote us in and said he'd be beyond honored if we'd have a listen. He said to Will that GGTMC is a huge influence on it. And let me just say right now that you're going to notice quite a bit of similarity in terms of format. But hey, if we can influence the discovery and love of cinema like this to anywhere near the level you guys have, it will be a dream come true. Let me also say how much GGTMC means to me. Been a listener for about 6 years, and you two have got me through some incredibly tough times. You've inspired me to emulate the good vibes. Thanks for everything you've done. I know a ton of people feel exactly the same way as me about that. And their homepage is... it looks like it's pod.co/caliber-9-from-outerspace. I'd imagine if you Google search Caliber 9 from Outer Space, you will find it. And he says, thanks again and big love to the GGTMC posse. So thanks, Rob. We appreciate that.
Thank you, man. That's very kind words, right? And I think you and I forget sometimes that we've been fortunate enough to have a lot of friends, a lot of people who've listened, a lot of people that have said things like that, that we've kind of helped them get through a tough time. And that's really, really humbling and really inspiring. But I think it comes down to you and I being very conversational, being very dear friends and keeping the good vibes, man. Like I was saying to someone the other day that when we do the show, we tend not to rant and rave about the negatives. You know, we try to bring up stuff. You know, we'll card someone for their lack of something, but it's about the positive vibes, right? We like to see like the golden retriever in the Hawaiian shirt, 80s poker visor and sunglasses. I feel like
yes,
that if there was a spirit animal for our show, it would be that.
Yes. Yes. Maybe a platypus in that same getup. But
yeah, man.
A nice mix of creatures. And I am in my personal life, I am a glass half empty person. Always have been. That's not to say that I'm negative everywhere I go or anything like that. I try to be positive. I really do. Even though I feel that way inside, I don't spread that because, you know, life is short. It just, you know, there's a part of me that's always trying to look at the bright side. And then this is what I try to do. You know, I know where my heart lies. I'm a bit more pessimistic, transgressive cinema, yada, yada, yada. But where I kind of aim is always glass half full. So, you know, you have these choices in life you got to make. This past year has been a real test on me. And not to get into faith or anything, because I'm not a man of faith, but a real test on my spirit of wanting to even keep moving forward. I've learned some big things about myself this past year. So it's been a growing moment, even though it comes from a moment of tragedy in a lot of ways. So, it's interesting how that stuff can shape you and change you as you get older. And, you know, obviously, you know, you've had some tragedy in the last few years. You know, life is, it can pound you. It can beat you up. But one of the great things about talking about movies, as silly as this sounds, one of the great things about doing this podcast, we've talked about 1,000 times, is it gets us together And it reminds us how much we have a collective love of something. And that means a lot, right?
It definitely does. You know, and it's that thing, as we've gotten older, I try to understand that, yeah, life's a package deal, right? And yeah, you got to take the good with the bad, man. You got to just celebrate the bad and try to push through celebrate the good. I don't know if I said celebrate the bad. That's maybe cinematically, but you know, you want to celebrate the good, move through the bad, keep your legs moving, know the sun's going to rise tomorrow. And having this show as an outlet socially and creatively in a way, I think really gives us a warm leather and denim quilt in which to wrap ourselves up in.
Yes. And you know, for me is, I'll say this too, for me as a creative personality, you know, ex-musician,
but not an ex-drummer.
No, not an ex-drummer. We'll talk about that here again in a minute, oddly. Not an ex-drummer, but then as an ex-musician and, you know, ex-writer, still a little bit of a writer and things like that, I have to have a creative outlet. So the podcast really gives me something to pursue. So it really helps me psychologically. But not only that, it keeps me in touch with people. I am, as Will will tell you, this is maybe a little behind-the-scenes information and maybe a little too private, but I feel like I share quite a bit about myself on this show. I am the kind of person that will insulate myself. I will disappear. Yes. I can live inside my head quite a bit. And I don't do it to be rude. I just, that's where I isolate myself. So Will's a great friend, and all my other friends are great friends because they're not so much like that, most of them. Not that I know of, anyway. They might be. I might be outing them right now, but it keeps me going. So that's important because, Jesus, if it was up to me, sometimes I'd just, you know, if I had a chair and a stack of books, I'd just, you know, I just would not communicate. And that's not, again, I don't try to be rude. I just, you know, it's just who I am. It's something that's part of me. So, but we have built a community and I'm happy to be a part of that. It's made me social. It's made me appreciate all the great people that are out there. And Rob and your friend Joe, I subscribed just now while we were talking. I will check out the podcast as soon as I can. And we'll go over. And, you know, you can't go wrong with riffing on us a little bit. I mean, that's the sincerest form of flattery, I'd say.
I would say so as well, right? And I just, one final thing I want to say to people. If you're listening to this, you know, if you're out there, you're going through something, reach out, right? Reach out to people in your life. Reach out to, listen, I'm more than happy to talk to anyone that is going through something, right? Because sometimes it's about perspective and realizing that even though that light at the end of the tunnel is flickering and it seems distant, it's closer than you think.
Yes.
And there's always people in your life that care about you. Again, contrary to what you may think, what you're going through in that moment. So please know that.
Yes, indeed. Okay, I got a few other things here from other folks. This is from Walt, not an audio one. He said, he was talking about Christmas Story and said, unfortunately, as fine as movie as this is, it's overshadowed by the talent of its progenitor, Gene Shepard or Jean Shepard? I don't know. I never remember.
Yeah, I always think it's Gene, but
yeah,
I could be wrong.
And he recommends anyone seek out his writing and radio work, mid-century nostalgic glow. There are other adaptations of his work, including some TV movies that originally aired on PBS. They're on YouTube in terrible quality. Films such as The Phantom of the Open Hearth, The Great American 4th of July, and Other Disasters. It's a great title. And this is even a greater title, Ollie Hap Noodles, Haven of Bliss. So those are on YouTube, says Walt. So that's crazy.
I got to see them. You know, I've always, Christmas Story is one we talk about obviously all the time, and it's very well loved. If maybe arguably the most well loved Christmas film of our generation. But I've always wanted to check out more Shepard stuff, knowing that they're pretty accessible like that. I got to gotta get in.
Yeah, I'm going to check it out too.
Good looking out, Walt, as always.
Always. This one's from Justin. He writes in and says, hi to you both and Happy New Year. Been a long time listener of your podcast. Had to stop the latest episode to try and watch a film you mentioned towards the beginning, Ex-Drummer. I've never heard of this film or the director, but your mention of it intrigued me. Managed to find it on YouTube. Wow. And he says, and wow, what an experience. What a grimy, nihilistic treat. An intense way to start the new year, but this is why your podcast is so important to lovers of cinema. I now need to see more of this director's work. Thank you for recommending films like this and for being such a fun and interesting podcast. Regards, Justin. So there we go. We've brought another person into the world of X-Drummer, whether they like it or not.
Yeah, that's their baptism in the juice at the bottom of the garbage bag.
Yeah. That's a, you know, that's a film unlike many. I there's so many films we've covered, and that's one that really stands out. That one and Cry of a Prostitute, as far as Italian cinema goes, that one really stands out for me. And, you know, there's just so many that we've done. But I had never seen X-Drummer when we, I'm pretty sure when we covered it, I don't think I'd ever seen it. And it was, it left a scab. Left a scab and a scar. Definitely. It's a great film, though. I mean, we know we're talking about, you know, some of the transgression of it and some of the filthiness of it and the craziness of it. But as far as transgressive cinema goes, you could do a lot worse. This one's from John, who does the video show. And now for something a little bit different. He says he loved the Big City episodes. Like ourselves, he had only seen the Apu trilogy, which he thought was quite good. After listening to this episode, I did a double feature of the Big City and another of his films, The Hero, both wonderful. I got a couple of this or that's for you. So here we go. Taking it back to the 80s for you this week. Hot Dog the Movie or Hamburger the Motion Picture? What a time it was, the 80s. I don't know, Will. A Hot Dog the Movie or Hamburger the Motion Picture? Have you ever seen Hamburger the Motion Picture? I feel like we've talked about Hamburger.
Yeah, we have, and I have.
Okay.
But I love myself a good ski sex comedy in the 80s.
Yeah. Oh, yeah,
no. So I'm going to go the diggity dog on this one, man.
Look, I'm a fan of Hamburger the Motion Picture, as ridiculous it is. I believe Dick Butkus is in that film. mostly because it was something I wasn't supposed to be watching, but so was Hot Dog the Movie at the time when it came out. And I'm with Will. I enjoy a good ski sex comedy, and Hot Dog the Movie is a lot of fun. So I'm going to go there. That one's, go ahead.
I'll let you finish because it was rude of me to interrupt you.
No. I didn't really have anything else to add. I mean, I quite enjoyed Hot Dog the Movie.
Now, if it's a hot dog versus hamburger to eat, I'm taking a hamburger like 10 times out of 10, man.
So, yeah, I am too. Weirdly for me, hot dogs, this ought to say a lot about my appetite. Hot dogs for me are more like an appetizer than they are a food.
I get a barbecue, the hot dog's the app.
Yeah, so here's what happens. I'll be cooking hamburgers on a grill or steak or whatever. And I'll be getting hungry, and sometimes I'll just throw a hot dog on because you can grill a hot dog really quick.
Yep.
Throw a hot dog on and then get a bun, and then I'll be eating the hot dog while I'm grilling the rest of the other meat.
Yeah. You take it off, you just eat the wiener.
Yeah. Such a savage. But hey, man, you know, killing two birds with one stone there. You gotta knock it out.
You know what? That's one of those things like.
It's a total dad thing to do.
I was just about to say that, man. Such a dad thing. Like when your dad hands you like the hot dog right off the grill.
Yes.
You get the first one before everyone else does. It's like,
yeah.
It's like you've been knighted.
Yeah.
It's incredible.
Yeah. And I've got my son that way too. Like I'll say, I'm going to cook up some hamburgers, and he'll say, you going to do any hot dogs? I'm like, well, of course I'm going to do a hot dog. It's like, I'm not going to plan on cooking a bunch of hot dogs, but you want a hot dog? And we'll throw one on there and, you know, just lather it in condiments and go for it. Or just eat it plain. Either way, doesn't matter. Hot dogs, fast cook, easy meal. But not something that, I sit down to eat for a meal. This is not something I do. So,
no, I don't eat very many hot dogs at this point in my life, to be fair. But
got to really crave them at this point.
Yeah. You got to really crave them.
Yeah.
I will say this. I feel like... eating them, so yeah, I don't eat them very, if ever, hardly, but there was a time, and I did love them.
yeah.
But shout out to frying them in a cast frying pan. Doesn't matter if it's cast, who gives a shit?
Yeah.
Fry it in a frying pan with some onions. Onions first, get them a little golden, put the hot dogs in, then with some mustard. Oh man.
Yeah, 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 yeah. No, no, I'm totally down for that.
That's but I remember the salad days of my youth when I would eat raw hot dogs right out of the fridge.
Oh, I did like, the same thing, man.
Man, that I was.
I did the same thing, and then I thought I was an artiste, and I would grab a hot dog out of the fridge, and I would wrap a piece of cheese around the hot dog and eat it like that. And I was like, who needs to cook it?
Artisanal food, right there, man.
Yeah,
artisanal
yeah.
food.
That's right. That's
good,
gotta,
man.
Got to keep going. You got to protein up.
You
know, I was playing basketball or something, doing something outside, and I was like, hey, man, I got to get something to eat real quick and run in, grab a dog, throw some cheese around it, get back on the bike, and go to town. Riding down the one-handed, eating a dog and cheese.
Life is good.
Yeah. Well, now I'd probably throw up if I did that, but that's okay.
As would I.
Yeah. Number two here, Fast Times at Ridgemont High or The Last American Virgin? Now, this is the one maybe. I don't think you've seen The Last American Virgin, right?
No, I have not. I'm almost certain I have not. I'm very familiar with it. I know you're a fan. But I've never seen it, man.
Yeah, I got it.
By default.
Okay, yeah. Well, this is a weird one for me because it's I love both of these films for what they are. Fast Times at Ridgemont High, I think, is just a classic. But I am a strong proponent of Last American Virgin. I really like it. I'm not going to talk too much about it because I've been meaning to pick it for this show forever, to be honest, because Will has never seen it. And it's an interesting one. It's definitely a time capsule, but it's one that I've been meaning to pick forever. So I'll just say that I'll stick with The Last American Virgin. Will can stick with Fast Times at Ridgemont High, and neither one of us are wrong. Let's put it that way.
I was going to say the last one there, Hot Dog. We got to do like an 80s sex ski comedy at some point. We don't really get into this too much.
No, well, I mean, obviously they're quote unquote problematic nowadays, but it was just like all cinema we cover. It was an era, and you can't ignore it. That doesn't do any good. You know, you just talk about what it is, but I would totally be down for that. I love that. Obviously, I was a growing prepubescent boy around that time and that cinema means a lot to me. Thankfully, I didn't turn into some weird creep. But again, those movies were made, I think, innocently and made to generate money. They look bad in retrospect, some of them, but I don't think that was the intention. The intention was to get people in the movie theaters and sex sold at the time. So that's just the way it was. I mean, anytime you think about it, it's kind of weird. They're making movies about teenagers having sex, but only adults can go see it. It's a weird concept from the get-go. So,
yeah.
But, it just that was the era of cinema it was. I grew up during that time. So, better soundtrack, heavy metal. This is the animated film. Or the animated Transformers movie. A little bit more of a curveball on that one. What do you think?
You know, I was just watching some of G.I. Joe, the animated movie, the other day.
Oh, really?
Yeah, with a buddy of mine, just watching old, like, Thundercat commercials and toy commercials. And G.I. Joe, we were talking about that, and the opening is just incredible. Mm-hmm. Statue of Liberty and the balloons and Duke swinging his star-spangled dick from the top of the
Yeah, it's very interesting.
But I would say and this is a little bit by default because I haven't seen the Transformers movie in a few years. Heavy Metal soundtrack I'm a little more familiar with. I quite like it. I love that film. I've been to show my kids Heavy Metal for a long time. So I'm going to go with Heavy Metal, but that's not a slight to Transformers. I don't recall it at this time.
I know a few of the songs from the Transformers movie. Obviously, The Touch is in there. The one that, Mark Wahlberg sings in Boogie Nights. You got the touch.
It's amazing.
So there's some of that type material in there. So I'm aware of it. But I am a fan of the heavy metal film. I believe that Harold Ramis and John Candy and a bunch of people like that were associated with that. Like it was a Canadian production. I think they were a big fans of the magazine. It was a comic magazine. And there was a magazine I couldn't buy for a long time because I was too young. It's an adults only magazine. You had to be 18 to buy it. And because of nudity and things like that. and a very transgressive comic. But the movie's a bit transgressive too. I haven't watched it in forever. I need to maybe revisit it sometime. But I do remember liking the music in it quite a bit. Now, it's also kind of a bit of an unfair advantage to me because that's kind of the music that I kind of grew up listening to in some ways through my dad. So that music kind of stuck with me, even though I didn't like it at the time. As so often is the case when you're a kid, you don't like anything that your parents listen to, watch, or read, or do anything. And then when you get older, you're like, oh, I see what they were doing there. Or I see what the quality is. I mean, because, you know, you're a kid, right? You know, and, you know, I'm sure, you know, you appreciate the things you appreciate, but you also, as you get older, I think you appreciate the things they appreciated as well. Mm-hmm. Just kind of happens that way. So I would have to go back and look. I just remember, I can't remember the name of that artist, but I remember that there was some serious hair metalage in, not that there wasn't in heavy metal, but there definitely was in Transformers the movie. But, you know, Transformers the movie is also a movie I've only ever seen like once or twice.
Yeah, I've seen it a couple of times. Maybe that's it, right?
Yeah. I wasn't a big Transformers guy.
Yeah, you took the words of my mouth. I was just talking about this. I was always a G.I. Joe guy.
Yeah.
And then He-Man.
Yeah.
Thundercats, yeah. Which were you like with Thundercats? Like, were you?
I was a little too old for Thundercats, but I kind of appreciated Thundercats. By the time Thundercats hit, I was, you know, as you get to be early teenage, preteen, you're like, cartoons are for kids, man.
That's it.
But my brother, thankfully, I had a younger brother, 3 years younger. And so a lot of that stuff kind of permeated my life anyway. But I do remember I did like Thundercats enough to buy a few of the action figures.
Oh, nice.
So I must have watched it in some capacity a little bit more than I let on. But I did like Thundercats. I like Thundercats more than I like Transformers. I don't think, for me, Transformers was cool. But I just, you know, it felt limited to me at some level. I don't know why.
Light my fire the way G.I. Joe did, man.
Yeah, that one felt like limitless. Like it felt did. Like they could do anything with that and keep doing it. And they would create characters and you're like, oh man, I can't wait till the figure comes out. And you know, that one really felt that way. And even He-Man in some ways felt limitless, even though if you go back and watch that show, it's very limited.
it definitely is. I feel like G.I. Joe has aged better, despite obviously sort of like Reagan era politics. So listen, it's a kid's show. It's awesome. But I just got to shout out my buddy Kurt. He did a really amazing Baroness impression the other night.
Nice.
You did some G.I. Joe impressions because you're pretty good with your impressions, man.
Yeah, I'd have to go back and listen to some of that stuff. I used to do a Destro, so I can probably still do that. Yeah, I used to do a Destro. I used to have fun with that. And oddly, I used to do a Panthro from Thundercats. So I'd probably have to go back and listen to it. So
there's a through line there.
Yeah, there is definitely a through line of Panthro and Destro. As a matter of fact, I wouldn't be surprised if it wasn't the same voice actor in some ways. I was always a big Destro fan, though. He was always ridiculous, right? He had that gigantic sweater-like crop-type top thing and had some silver chest showing.
Him and the Baroness, man, you know.
Yeah, I'd have to go back and listen to it to get the impersonation down, though. Definitely. But I haven't, like I said, I haven't listened in a long time. So thanks, John. Appreciate that. And again, his video show, I believe it's called "And Now for Something a Little Bit Different." Do a Google search of it there, and again,
yeah, give it a listen, give it a like, give it a subscribe, guys. You know. Putting hard work into this and love, and it's just chicken soup for the soul when you know you get people engaging with something that you're putting out there, like you're this Valentine, right?
Yeah. John, he's definitely a cinema lover of our ilk. In other words, like most of us, there's not really a genre, film, or era he doesn't like. which is that's the way it should be. Okay. Let's get into what we've been watching and, we'll go from there. What you got, man?
So yes, what have I watched? Let's see here. Had a decent week.
Oh, wow.
this one, a lot of people had seen it last year. We wanted to watch them as a family. And, you know, the kids are getting a little older, so sometimes stuff that we could have wheeled them into before, they don't want to see. And my wife doesn't always want to watch horror movies. So
Yeah.
Sport. But we decided to throw on Air, the...
Oh, yeah.
Like Jim.
Yeah. With the my favorite hairpiece of the last year, the Ben Affleck hairpiece. I love it.
So you know what's funny about that? I said this on the show before, but I feel like every promotional photo you saw for the film was him in like that windbreaker and those ridiculous sunglasses. He must have thought he looked so cool in that getup because every promotional photo, it wasn't Matt Damon, it was him.
Yeah.
In like 80s gear. But I like this. I didn't love it. I thought it was good. It was an interesting approach, obviously, to do this the way they did, obviously, without his airness. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting, right? I mean, I'm talking to my kids about this, and I'm saying, guys, like, this was a time when hip-hop culture wasn't what it was. It was very burgeoning. The shoe industry as they know it and as we know it today just didn't exist.
No.
So it's really fascinating to go back and look at it like that and to look at Nike, I guess, mm-hmm. pre-Nike, as we know them, and the creation of the shoe and the gamble. And yeah, it's a good film. I mean, it's kind of straightforward, but I think Affleck directs it with a little bit of style, even though it's sort of A to B to C.
Yeah, I think it's that's a good way to describe it. I think it's just a really solid movie. I don't think it's great.
No.
But it's it's very watchable.
It is very watchable, right? Mm-hmm. Like, it looks good. They get the period stuff down. They're having fun with the period stuff. Jason Bateman's good supporting cast.
Yeah, the acting. I like most of the acting, I believe.
I think it's one of those where you'll come out of there, and I don't think anyone's going to come out, I'm not saying anyone, but by and large, I don't think you're going to come out of it and go, man, I fucking hated Air.
You know? No. If all else fails, you'll come out of it and say, it was good. That's about as bad as you're going to say about it, probably.
Yeah, exactly.
Also, I want to say for the record, I don't know if I said it when I said I watched it, but I do think it's actually Michael Jordan is so big. I don't think if they would have cast any actor, I think it would have been too much.
I agree. I feel like this was the best way to do it.
Yeah, you would have paid too much attention to what that actor was doing as Jordan, as opposed to everybody else in the cast, which I think the story is about everybody else. So
yeah,
that's the way to go.
Which if you see Winning Time, the LA Lakers show on HBO, they do a good job with that because, I mean, you have to have Magic front and center. Mm-hmm. The performance is good in that show. Of course, John C. Reilly as Jerry Buss is incredible. But so yeah, watch the Air. Watched one. I got to say, I was really disappointed in. I really didn't care for it. None of us did. It's No One Will Save You.
Oh, that's the one. What is that one? Is that the one about aliens? Is that about aliens, maybe?
Yeah, like an alien home invasion film.
Yeah. I haven't seen it yet. I can't remember who the director is.
I think he's relatively new. I think he directed a couple other things. But, man, I just... I'd heard from a few people I really liked, that I really sort of respected their opinion, that this was pretty good. And... starts off promising enough. It's kind of a not quite one location, but they take this premise of it's almost dialogue free. Brian Duffield's the director. So interestingly, he directed Spontaneous. I really loved. Did you see Spontaneous?
I did not see Spontaneous. No,
I loved it.
I know he wrote Love and Monsters, which I did quite like quite a bit.
I like Love and Monsters as well. And he wrote The Babysitter and.
Yeah, I didn't see Spontaneous. Son.
Spontaneous is really good, man. Really good. Like, if you need to move something light, I say light. It's about teenagers exploding, but it's kind of a cute love story. It's good. Like I said, all of us liked it. But, I just, I don't know. It felt like a little too gimmicky, and the gimmick gets dragged out a little too much. It's got some interesting stuff in it. Like, I didn't hate it, but... I don't know. They hang on to the gimmick, I think, to the detriment of the film at times.
Right.
So it was okay, man. I didn't really dig it. What else did we get into? Man, this might have been sort of had eluded me for 20 years. So it was Braden and I home, and he digs anime and stuff. So, and he digs Daft Punk. And it popped into my head. I was driving one day. I thought, why don't we watch Interstellar 5555? So this is an animated film that came out, I want to say, like 2003. Mm-hmm. And the film is essentially I think it's about an hour long, give or take. Yeah, about an hour long. It's no dialogue. Okay, it's music for it is their second album, mm-hmm. Discovery. So the album Discovery is playing as the film is unfolding, but it's very easy to follow. They get pretty high, like Toei Animation did the animation. Mm-hmm. It's got that late 70s, early 80s anime look. Quite liked it, but I think mileage is going to vary with this. If you're a Daft Punk fan, I think you'll really dig it. If you're not, maybe not so much.
Yeah.
Maybe not so much.
Yeah. I've known of it. It's one of those ones that it's always eluded me. I haven't ever had a chance to watch it.
So it's called, so the tagline is the animated house musical.
Yeah.
Well, you know, that should tell you that's, if anything, I think it's a very niche, right? The crowd, but that's Daft Punk, man. They make the things that they want to make with the aesthetic they want to make, and mm-hmm. either you like it or you don't. And that ticks the boxes for me. So it was good. Next up was Last Night in Soho.
Oh yeah. I've seen this. Yes.
Yeah. So I, as I've said before, Edgar Wright, I don't know, man, it just sometimes he gets under my skin. I didn't mind this. As always, I think Anya Taylor-Joy is fantastic. I think from a production standpoint, it looks really good. I think it's an interesting concept, but it's solid. It's a solid film, you know. But for a guy like Wright, I expect better than kind of 6.5 territory. But, you know, maybe that's an unfair expectation. But I don't know. I liked it, didn't love it. Where did you fall on this one?
I can't really remember. I think it was more like, I think I liked it, but I definitely didn't love it. There's no doubt about that. There's some things about it I really liked and some things about it I didn't like at all. I don't know. It felt kind of empty when I was done with it.
Yeah, that's the thing, right? And that's the thing I get with his stuff, man. It always, to me, feels very, to the detriment of the film, very self-referential, sort of self-satisfied. Mm-hmm. And I guess, you know, directors are making things for themselves. And I just, you know, I sound a bit hypocritical here. I just talked about Daft Punk doing that and it's kind of celebrating that. But I guess it comes down to that thing of all of this being very subjective. But for me, Wright, he's a good filmmaker, but sometimes his stuff gets a little too up his own ass for my own good. Mm-hmm. As I've said, though, Anya Taylor-Joy, I think, is well on her way to being an A-lister. She's going to headline the new Furiosa film. I love her. I think she's fantastic. I've seen her elevate stuff that, you know, like that New Mutants film she was in, despite having to do a ridiculous sort of Russian accent as Colossus's sister.
Yes.
No,
I haven't seen the film, but yes,
it's okay. It could have been so much better, but yeah, she's a heavy hitter, man. She's a heavy hitter. And that's all I'll talk about.
Okay. I watched a few things. I continued after we recorded. I continued the Mission Impossible thing. I only got one to watch now to catch up, I think. This is Fallout. This one was pretty good. A little overlong on this one. I think Rogue Nation might be better. This one just kind of wears out its welcome after a while. But also, you know, it's a very Tom Cruise movie. And if you're, you know, again, that's a genre unto itself. And I enjoyed it for definitely for what it is. Great helicopter sequence. Really good helicopter sequence. So, as a matter of fact, I don't know how they pulled some of it off, but that's what these movies have become. They become these kind of crazy ideas somebody has and they kind of find a way to pull it off. I don't know how they pulled this one off. I really don't. Helicopters are so tricky. But it's really cool. quite enjoyed it, though. I mean, I gotta say, the Mission Impossible movies, I mean, obviously they've changed from what the original Brian De Palma film was. Not that he was, it was a Brian De Palma film, it was a work for hire job, but you know, that was more based on the espionage. You know, ever since then, they've kind of become, obviously, Tom Cruise. Well, I don't know, John Woo's movie's definitely a John Woo movie.
Oh, yeah.
But they pretty much, since Mission Impossible 3, they pretty much have become just, you know, Tom Cruise action movies. And, you know, for that, they're fine. They're very good. And I enjoy that. Change Gears, watched one on New Year's Day that I'd been meaning to watch forever. And finally just said, you know what, I'm going to watch it. I'm going to check it out. And it's crazy to me that it's already been out for 5 years. counting New Year's Day being the 2024. And that's Ad Astra. Isn't that crazy? It's been out 5 years already.
Oh, I'm very curious because I really love this film.
I like this movie a lot. I did. But I found that when we got to where we needed to go, I felt like they really dropped the ball.
It does lose a little bit of its propulsiveness when we get to
the
objective.
I don't want to give it away, obviously, because it could be very spoilery. But you know, obviously, it's kind of based on Apocalypse Now in some ways, or Joseph Conrad's Heart of Darkness in some ways. And a lot of the stuff building up to it's really good. I liked a lot of it. I really did. And I do like the film overall. I do think it's very good. I just think that the payoff wasn't what I wanted it to be. It does have some emotional rips and some tides there that I quite enjoyed, but the explanation was like almost so brief that I was like, okay, you know. And again, I don't want to say anything because I'm afraid I'll give too much away. But it was just so brief, the explanation. I was like, wow, I mean, is this all? I mean, we could have figured that out without ever talking to that character ever again. I did enjoy it quite a bit. It's interesting. James Gray's films are like that for me sometimes. I like his films. I find them very deep. And then sometimes it gets to the back end and I find that he has trouble sticking the landing. It's been that way. I think he did that City of Z film with Charlie Hunnam.
Oh, which I did not want to see. And then did not Z, but now, you know, I heard good things about it. So I've been kind of circling around it for years.
Yeah, you know, it's good. It's a good film. Him and Rob Pattinson. It's a really good movie. It has trouble with the ending, and that's the same way I felt about this one.
Yeah, it's funny you say that. But I think for me, this had built up enough goodwill. It felt really muscular. I can't remember what I said at the time. It felt kind of like a little Nolan, a little Malick. It's like if Nolan and Malick had a baby, I guess, in a way, and made this film about something very sprawling. But had a very intimate at its core, right?
I mean, I guess obviously I can see the Nolan side. Can definitely see some of the Malick side. Probably see more Apocalypse Now than anything.
Oh yeah, for sure.
And that's definitely the vibe I get the most. But unlike that, I just don't think it. I don't think it lands its theoreticals as well as I think it does.
Didn't he also do, what was it? Give me a sec here. I don't want to speak out of turn. Yeah, so he did. So I find that too, actually, with some of his films. Like Two Lovers, The Immigrant. All of his films, you know, I don't know if this is just the power of suggestion, but I just feel like I really like him as a filmmaker. But yeah, a lot of his stuff tends to, like Little Odessa is another one. Really good film. Really good film. Mm-hmm. Tim Roth. Shout out Tim Roth on that one. But I don't know, man. Yeah, it just peters out a little bit. Builds up really strong, you know, first act, middle piece, and then, this is true.
Yeah, I don't know. He's really good at creating characters, and his characters are great. I just, you know, I mean, this is not a slight against James Gray because, you know, I think one of America's great storytellers, Stephen King, is the same way. I mean, I was going to say
King earlier when we were talking. Absolutely.
He's somebody that also has trouble with endings, and that's okay. I mean, you don't have to end things with a punch. You don't have to. Sometimes the journey is more important than the end game. So I think that James Gray does that very well. And of course, I'm always interested in everything he does. Definitely an interesting filmmaker. And, you know, he makes these films, believe it or not, relatively cheaply and is able to pull it off. And that's pretty good. And again, I would watch this again. I would definitely watch it again. It's not that kind of movie. But I just think, you know, I think I wanted to spend more time with that relationship toward the end. I felt like it was abbreviated, if that makes sense.
It does.
Let's see. I'm going to mention one more here. We're under a time limit today. Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny.
Oh, wow.
So I watched this. Obviously, I am a child of the Indiana Jones era. I thought I'd check it out. Check it out. And, you know, it got quite beat up by critics and everybody else. Of course, you know, once it got released that it was a $350 million movie.
$350
million? Yeah. A lot of people pushed back on it. It's kind of the same thing that happened with Fast X when it got released that it was a $300 million movie. And, you know, these movies now, these big blockbusters, you know, that's what they're dropping on these things. You know, $300 million. I think Avatar was a $300 million movie as well. And, you know, that's just the market. The market is spend a lot and try to make $1 billion. It's been that way for a while, but now it seems like they're really pushing that because there's no real in-between cinema anymore. And, you know, it's either low budget or it's big budget. There's really not a whole lot. There are the occasional ones in between. A good example might be James Gray's Ad Astra, right? That's kind of an in-betweener now. But I think that was a $40 or $50 or $60 million movie, which is, you know, crazy to think that that's the in-betweeners now.
But it looks like the money's on the screen. Like, it looks the really good bang for the buck.
Yeah, right? I don't know. You can't say that about Indiana Jones and the Dial of Destiny. That's one of the things that I think people pushed the most was, you know, if it costs that much, where's the money at on screen? A lot of it's shot in front of a green screen. You can kind of tell. It's well done as far as green screen stuff goes. But, I mean, you know, it's obvious that it's, you know, people in studios. Obviously, there's aging technology used on Harrison Ford. It looks better than it did in The Irishman. So that'll get better as time goes on, which you expect. But obviously also, you know, he's an 80-year-old something man. He's not doing the stunts, and you can clearly tell it's not him. That's not a bothersome thing to me. I mean, I knew that going in, so I can buy that. I can move on from that. I think the bothersome thing for me is the story of this one. This one really goes outside of its Indiana Jones boundaries, maybe a little too much. And as good as the cast is in this film, and, you know, Mads Mikkelsen's even in here, but he doesn't really even stand out as much as you want Mads Mikkelsen to stand out, obviously, who typically stands out in everything he's in, right? So he doesn't really stand out here. He's just kind of there. And it just, I think the biggest problem with this movie is it's a $350 million movie, but it's kind of a layabout movie. It's not an event movie. It doesn't feel like it's big. It just feels like a standard movie. I think it's better than Crystal Skull, which when we started this podcast, that was out.
Yep.
I think it's better than that, but not much. Not much better than that.
Never saw that. I got to be honest. Like, for me, it's just, I don't know, man. You know, you've talked about this with superhero films, and hey, people want to see the ones. I don't begrudge anyone for seeing anything. I just think it's kind of a shame, not that these films are being made, but that the budgets are what they are, because then they become very high stakes, and it just pushes a lot of films out that have a little more creative freedom, right? And this is an age-old thing for people to say, but that's just $350 million, and having actors we love, that, you know, people behind the camera that are just, you know, incredible. And this is what we get, kind of a stale fart. Like, really? Yeah.
Well, I think that for me, that is the problem. That is the issue with what became, and that's what I saw, what I personally saw coming with the Marvel films, was that they were hiring these people that, to me, they're not great filmmakers. Are they better filmmakers than me? Hell yeah, they are. Can they manage gigantic productions? Hell yeah, they can. But again, I'll say this until I'm blue in the face. none of those Marvel films are going to inspire a next generation of cinema. I'm sorry, they're just not. I just don't think they're that cinematic. I don't think they're going to inspire cinema like a Martin Scorsese or like even a Quentin Tarantino or even a Ron Howard. I just don't think they're going to do that because, again, if you've seen anything the Russo brothers have done or any of those other directors have done, hardly any of them have really done anything that's very interesting outside of the Marvel films they did.
No, but I'm going to respectfully disagree with you as far as the inspiration thing goes.
Yeah, maybe.
I'll tell you why, because go ahead, you finish.
No, I mean, my hope is that it doesn't, because I think Marvel took away cinematics and made it more kind of a TV scope type thing. And that's the problem I had, is it turned cinema into television, and television in return became more cinematic.
Ironically enough, yes. But to me, I will disagree respectfully with this. I think this will influence a generation of children, just in the same way that Star Wars did. I don't think Star Wars is high art.
I disagree with the first Star Wars. The first Star Wars is definitely high art. Two and three, definitely not.
One is good, but to me, it's still, you know, it's, I don't think it's anything. And here I'm going to get myself in some hot water. don't love Star Wars.
Yeah.
I've been very forthright saying that I don't begrudge anyone for what they love. It doesn't stir my soul, but it did stir a lot of souls. And yeah. I can tell you the emotional feeling I had watching Guardians of the Galaxy, watching Captain America get Mjolnir in his hand. Give me chills.
Yeah. The only problem with that is you had 20 films to build that up.
We did.
But Star Wars, you had none.
Fair. But here's the thing. You're going to have this 20 films over the span of 2 or 3 years is getting baked into these kids. I think some kids will definitely be inspired by these. This is like the Star Wars for their generation because, you know, there certainly wasn't the economy of storytelling that you had with one film, but this universe that was created. Now, like you said, from a creative standpoint, do I like that what the model has done to the industry? No. I certainly don't. You know, I'll always want independent film and as many sort of diverse voices behind the camera as we can have. And this didn't help that any. It became high stakes poker over and over and over, bigger, 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 to the point where you tell me a film costs $350 million and I'm just flabbergasted.
Yeah.
I remember when $100 million was the benchmark. Well, that's 30 years ago. Mm-hmm. But Cameron put it on screen. And, you know, as much as I don't love Avatar.
Yeah. You can see
the money on screen.
Yeah.
So it's just, it's wild to me.
Yeah.
We'll move on. And again, I don't mean to disparage. This is
No. I don't think so. I don't.
Disparaging what people love, but wow. Wild.
Yeah. I don't think anybody disparages what anybody loves. I think that, you know, Star Wars is Akira Kurosawa.
Oh, totally is.
Whereas the Marvel universe I think it's created a generation of fans who want money on screen. And I think what Star Wars did is it showed you that it had limitations, whereas Marvel never showed this whole generation that there's limitations. And I think that's creatively bankrupt. Because now what you see, most criticisms you see from young people are, the effects don't look good. And that is a problem. To me, that's a problem. And I blame Marvel for that, because there was a time when effects didn't matter if they looked good or not. You could have a rubber monster, but now you can't have that. You got to have perfect effects. And it's created, I think, a generation of fans who want everything to be perfect. And that's a problem.
Speaking of rubber monsters, we're going to talk about one next week. A couple of rubber monsters.
Yeah, a couple of them, yeah. Definitely.
And in fact, they improved. My perspective.
They did. Okay. We'll see. We're hounding up on time here. That's all I watched. Time is a fickle beast. It's a tempting mistress. For next week, it's a succubi.
It sure is, man. It puts the suck in succubi.
We love the succubi here at the GGTMC, no doubt. But what do you know what time it might be?
I know what time it is.
What time is it, man? What time you got?
It's not time for succubi yet.
No.
Except for this or that.
Now, if I can just get the computer to react to your this or that. One of these days, I'm going to have it ready. I need to. One of these days, I'm just going to invest in a soundboard. You know, for you, for those of you who don't know, you know, the podcasting world has changed a lot since we started podcasting. I mean, it's changed completely. And now you can buy these fancy boards and everything else and all this kind of stuff. Will and I still have the same mixers and the same microphones that we had started 15 years ago. And I have never upgraded my mic. I've never upgraded the mixer. The only thing I've added a boom stand for my microphone, but that's the only thing I've done in all those years.
I was saying that to someone today, man. 15 years strong.
Yeah. And at this point, it's almost like a point of pride to not update.
Hey, shout out Alessis.
Yes. Yeah, exactly. Because they've really maintained. And I'm always worried that one day I'm going to wake up and turn it on and it's not going to work anymore.
I just hope we didn't say the word no hitter right now.
Yeah. All right. What do you got for this or that?
So I definitely got some here.
All right. But to keep it tight because we got a schedule to maintain.
Five here very quickly.
Will's on a personal schedule. We got a schedule set up for the next show.
Yeah, we do. Jennifer Coolidge or Kim Cattrall?
Oh.
Why not both?
Yeah. Why not both? So this is interesting. Jennifer Coolidge is more my type. Seriously, totally more my type.
Jennifer Coolidge, man.
but it's weird. Kim Cattrall, there's always been something about Kim Cattrall.
Oh yes, there has.
And I don't know where that comes from because she weirdly is not my type.
Call me David Lopan.
Yes. Nice. Hope somebody gets that for a sound clip. There's nothing low about your pan right now.
Oh, my pan ain't low, baby.
Call you David High Pan. David Long Pan. The truth is, there's just something about Kim Cattrall. I don't know what it is, but she has always exuded sexuality to me. She's just a very sexy person.
I think both of these women do. And I think
they both do.
Great comedic timing in addition to being very aware of their overt sexuality.
Coolidge has definitely, they found her niche and they exploited it. And she has shown her talent as a comedic actress. And Cattrall has went back and forth, but she's also done some silly stuff outside of in some interviews and stuff like that that kind of hurt her a little bit. But I got to say, I'm going to go Kim Cattrall, even though Coolidge is more my type. I'm going to go Kim Cattrall. Maybe it's a nostalgic thing because she's been around since I was, again, I mean, she was in Porky's. So yeah. She's been around since, that early time. So maybe that's it. But I'm going to go Kim Cattrall. And I do like her quite a bit, right? With Split Second, Porky's, Big Trouble in Little China, arguably one of the greatest films ever made.
Yes.
And there's a number of other films that I'm not even thinking of off the top of my head. She's actually been a big part of my film maturity.
Yeah, I agree. I think, like I said, I think both are talented. I wish both were given more opportunities to shine and with Coens or, certain filmmakers that really could have used them well. I'm going to go Coolidge. And, this is flip a coin territory. I love both. I love both for the same reasons, even though, I love both. I'll say that. Chocolate covered pretzels or chocolate covered almonds?
So I'm a nut guy. That sounds. I'm talking about your David Lopans.
He does,
but right. I just discovered my daughter's actually allergic to tree nuts.
Oh,
just tree nuts though, not like peanuts. Very weird. Usually they're allergic to both, but she's just not. She's allergic to tree nuts, so she can't have almonds and things like that. That's okay. She doesn't like them anyway. Now. Chocolate covered nuts of all sorts are delicious. And you have to wonder sometimes, is it the nut? But I have to believe it is, because
it's the combination.
It is the combination. I love chocolate covered almonds. They are a very close second to my favorite chocolate covered nut, which is the cashew.
I don't know if I've ever had a chocolate covered cashew.
Oh man, they're ridiculous. No,
have some now.
Yeah, they're very fattening though. Be careful. The chocolate, I mean, cashews alone are kind of fattening, I think, but
there's some good fats as long as you don't eat like.
Yeah, yeah. Well, the problem is that I can eat 2 pounds. But I do love chocolate covered cashews, but I'm going to go chocolate covered almonds on this. I do enjoy chocolate covered pretzels, for the record. I do. But I'm going to go almonds.
I'm with you on this one. I think both are really upper tier. They elevated the art of the snack, both of them.
Yes. Yes, they definitely they are the Martin Scorsese of snacks. They have elevated it.
Scorsese and De Palma of snacks. Absolutely. Absolutely they are.
Nice. I love the terminology, they elevated the snack. I love that. It's awesome.
Yeah, they're good. Another food one here. Scrambled or poached eggs?
You know, we don't eat a lot of poached eggs down here.
So good, man.
Yeah, I need to try some more poached eggs. I've had them before. I like them. Of course, you know, we're in the South, so fried eggs are a big thing. But, you know, I like scrambled eggs. I'm going to go scrambled eggs. I haven't had enough poached to know.
Are Eggs Benedict big down there?
Not huge. They are relevant down here though, and I do have them occasionally.
Nice.
I like the sauce. What is it? There's like a it's like a horseradish, isn't it?
No, more like a creamy. It's yellow. How to describe? Sort of mayo mustard gravy. Had a baby. I don't know.
Yeah. Some kind of mix. Almost like a Dijon. Yeah. Almost like a Dijon mustard, maybe. Sort of a little Grey Poupon, maybe. But I do enjoy that flavor. So I definitely have Eggs Benedict more than poached.
Yeah, there you go, man. But this, yeah, if you to have poached eggs on their own as opposed to an Eggs Benedict, they're good, man. Toast, oh man, you can, toast is good. Anyway, Martha Plimpton or Ally Sheedy?
It's a weird one.
Yeah,
this is a it's an odd duck of this or that here. I'm gonna go Plimpton.
Yeah.
I don't know why.
No, hey, listen.
I don't have any justification for it. I'm going on my gut on this one.
I'll tell you why. Because Plimpton's great, not to discredit Sheedy. I think Plimpton's an excellent actress, and I wish.
Yeah, she is.
She kept working. She almost feels like the precursor to Samantha Morton in some ways. I don't know.
Ah, yes. Yeah.
You know, I love Plimpton. I think she's great. Yeah, I really like her. She's great. And is it Running on Empty? Yeah, Running on Empty. Oh, yeah. Man, that's a great one with River Phoenix. And
yeah, that's a good one. Yep.
Yeah, really good. Last one here. Last one. Joe Spinell. I'd do a riff.
Joe Spinell and Martha Plimpton in a video clip. my low pan is acting up.
Sweaty Joe.
Oh, yikes. Yeah, this is a kind of a tough one because Brad Dourif got to work so much longer, right?
He did.
And Brad Dourif's, he's one of those actors who can cross budgets, boundaries, genres, and do anything. He can be in the most highfalutin cinema that you can find and be totally good in it and work with the greatest actors on the face of the earth. And he can be in the lowest of lowbrow cinema.
And somehow elevate.
Yeah. And somehow he's still great, right?
Yeah.
My heart is with, so I'm just going to be honest. This is going to be a tough one and a tough one to say. My heart is with Joe Spinell, but my brain tells me I got to go Brad Dourif here because of the body of work and because he's proven that he can do anything, or he could do it. Is he still alive?
I believe he is.
I ask myself this question at least once a month. Is Brad Dourif still alive?
I know. Pretty sure he is.
You know, we joke around about it, but seriously, I do ask this question more often than you think.
He is.
Yeah.
Great state of West Virginia.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Shout out Zom, man.
Yeah. The Brad Dourif, the master of the one tier scene. Remember? I think we've talked about this before. He's one of those guys who can drop the single tier.
That very few can drop that single tier, man.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. He's very good at that. Even whips it out in Lord of the Rings.
Hey, Oscar nominated.
Yeah, yeah. I think he was. Right. Was Oscar nominated for One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. He's a gift. So here's the thing. I feel like Joe Spinell is the John Cazale of like character, like sort of character and expectation.
Of genre films, yes.
Genre film. I think both these guys are gifts to film that we don't give their roses enough to.
Yeah, yeah, like, they're not handsome leading men. No,
look at this. You know, you punch Brad Dourif's name into Google, portraying Grima Wormtongue, Lord of the Rings. Yeah. Oscar nominated for One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest. Voice Chucky. I mean, we go a million ways. Like Dourif's incredible. So this is not a slight to Dourif in any capacity because I think he's a tremendous actor.
Sure.
Yeah, and in a just world, would headline some films.
Yep.
But I got to go Spinell only for the promise of what I thought, you know, that, could have done.
Yeah, that is not a bad choice at all.
Because look at that, that scene, that really tender scene in Rancho Deluxe talking about.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know, his tribe and, you know, wanting pickup trucks and televisions and things. And it's a real heartbreaking, tender scene. Something Spinell didn't get a chance to do a lot.
That's right.
But I love both these guys.
Yeah.
They're both great. Like for people like us who love, love, love film, we see a lot of exploitation and genre films. These two guys, we know, like they're almost like the Willem Dafoe. Like Willem Dafoe is like the king of these guys, right? Like these are like, you know, he got to cross over and deservedly so. You know, I love Dafoe with all my heart, but these guys need to cross over or to Spinell needed to. Anyway,
yeah.
We got some Fuller to talk about. Yeah,
that's true. I don't think you can go wrong with either this or that on that one, though.
No.
Hey, you can make that argument. The both of those guys are, you know, they're the kind of actors we love here at The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, yeah. Right? So
you see their name in the credits, you smile, man.
Yeah, because you know you're going to get one scene.
Yeah.
You know,
that scene with Dourif in Exorcist 3 is tremendous.
It really is. And one of the reasons why I love the Exorcist 3 so much is because he's so good in that film. I mean, talk about an actor going full tilt. I mean, he's chewing scenery, but at the same time, he's got you caught up in it. It's amazing.
Yeah, he does. Yeah. Oh, he's good.
He never disappoints.
Nope.
All right. We're going to take a short break, and we're going to come back and talk 40 Guns from one Samuel Fuller. We'll be back right after this.
You'll be amazed at all the great things that Crisco can make.
Down the phones, throw hands in the mosh pit, laugh at the security, think they could stop shit. I love the sound it make when the Glock click. He left her ass and that made her heart sick.
I wanted this to be professional, efficient, adult, cooperative. Alas, Mr. Takagi did not see it that way, so he won't be joining us for the rest of his life.
I got 40 guns in my closet. Now I'm running out of room, need a bigger safe. Stop selling all those drugs, you should stop it. Yeah, I know I should, but I want a wraith. Lay back and
all right. How about that?
Is that Barry Sullivan? The fireman?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Or Robert Dix, actually. It's quite the song.
Dean Jagger, actually.
Dean Jagger, man. Sheriff Ned Logan. Dropping bars.
He is. He's got 40 guns in his closet. All right. So here we are talking about Sam Fuller on The Gentleman's Guide to Midnight Cinema, something that many would probably say is long overdue, and you would probably be correct. This is 40 Guns 1957, directed by Mr. Fuller. Showdown in Arizona between the Bunnell brothers, U.S. Marshals, and Jessica Drummond, the Iron Fist rancher who controls the territory. Now, one of the reasons why I wanted to pick this, first of all, we hadn't done enough Fuller. Lord, did I know that we hadn't done any Fuller on the show. But another reason is I was just in the mood for an old school Western. I grew up watching these kinds of films. And it's fun to kind of go back and look at these because they're essentially just very simple genre films. They're very much good guy, bad guy. But every now and then, even in the classic Westerns, you'll get a mix. You'll get a little, not a griff, but a little riff thrown in there. I'm making fun of the Griff character here. But Return of Barry Selvin, by the way, which I think he was on our show for Planet of the Vampires.
He was, and I actually inadvertently mentioned Planet of the Vampires. I mentioned it a few days ago, and I hadn't realized that we'd be talking about him this week.
Yep. But this one has Barbara Stanwyck in one of her last films. She would move on to TV after this. She would work until she was quite an older lady. She probably hasn't been on the show since Night Nurse, maybe.
With Joan Blundell, yeah. And we don't get a lot of Stanwyck, but tremendous actress. Yep. Glad to have her on. Glad to talk about her.
Unique face, right? Very unique.
Absolutely.
Barry Selvin, who we just mentioned here. Dean Jagger, who's been on the show before, I'm pretty sure. Sheriff Ned Logan. John Erickson, who definitely has been on the show before, I believe. What was the film that I know him from?
Bad Day at Black Rock.
Bad Day at Black Rock, yeah.
I looked that up. I'm not that encyclopedic.
Yeah, I remember that was the film. But I remember some other films that he's been in over the years. Bedknobs and Broomsticks. And
great one.
Weirdly, he did an Asian film. I don't think it's Asian, but I think it's Seven Faces of Dr. Lau. So he's one of these actors who, it's a George Powell film, actually. And I think that was when, that's when they were trying to do, that was Tony Randall playing an Asian.
What a time to be alive.
Yes. It was a weird time back when they would do Asian mysticism via white America. It was very strange.
You know what he was in? He did some genre stuff, though. He did a lot of TV, obviously, Streets of San Francisco, Police Story, SWAT. He did Hustler Squad, which I quite like. Great poster. Crash, House of the Dead, the 78 version.
Yeah, no, he was around for a long time. I mean, he just died 3 or 4 years ago.
Yeah, he worked.
He worked a lot. And he's a good looking guy. Yep. So he got a lot of work in films like this. We got Gene Barry, who I think Todd and I talked about him with War of the Worlds, the 1953 version.
Yep.
He's the one that's always smoking the cigar, one of the Bunnell brothers. Robert Dix, who Will mentioned a little while ago. I'm trying to think what else I know Robert Dix from. I got to know him from something. The Forbidden Planet, I know. Well, he did a lot. He definitely did a lot of GGTMC type films. Is he still alive? No, he passed away, but there was a film released with him in it playing Roger Frankenstein.
Yeah.
The last Frankenstein. But he died in 2018, but that film came out in 2021. So I wonder if that happened
or something.
But he's in like stuff like Satan Sadist and biker films and things like that. Al Adamson films. So he had some work in there. Jidge Carroll, I'll mention. Jidge Carroll doing some Elvis Presley-esque type singing here.
Big time.
There's a couple songs in here, two or three. And then a sorted amount of character actors pop up. Chuck Roberson, Gerald Milton.
Chuck Hayward, famous stuntman.
Yeah. They'll get people like that. They'll just kind of pop up throughout this film. Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
A little supporting role, yeah.
So it's kind of fun to kind of go through and see these. And obviously some of these people would go on to keep working with Fuller in some ways. So this one is shot. I think one of the interesting things to talk about with this one is it's shot in CinemaScope in black and white. So it's big. It's a big black and white, kind of an epic in a way, but only an 80-minute film. Well, I don't know if you'd ever seen this before, but what did you think about 40 Guns?
Really dug it, man. Really dug it. Fuller's a filmmaker. I'll be very forthright in saying, you know, I've seen three or four of his films. I'm very aware of what he means to cinema. I respect him, but just, you know, you can't get around to everyone, right? I was excited to watch this one too. This feels like, you know, one of those kind of Sunday afternoon watches, like you said, 80 minutes, nice and breezy. But the thing I like about this, and the thing I'll talk about, is just the human touches, or the stuff outside the box, or the stylistic touches that Fuller brings to the table here, much like Bud Boedeker did, right? Like with his Westerns or even Douglas Sirk did with his melodramas, right? Like there's a high technical proficiency, there's subtext. And that's the big takeaway for me here is this thing, this is a gorgeous film.
Yeah, it really is.
Gorgeous film. It's shot, yeah, CinemaScope. Really incredible use of shadows. Like the blacks and the shadows in this are just, they're really incredible, almost where it feels like a noir.
It really does. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it's fantastic. Sorry, give me just one sec here.
Yeah, no problem. I think that that is the key thing, is this film looks amazing. And it is almost a noir in a way. It is playing on those elements. It doesn't hurt that Barbara Stanwyck's in the film and she was a big part of film noir. But I do feel like that's what it's trying to go for with the story it's telling.
Yeah. Can we, let me back up here on my notes. You'd said this is on the Criterion Channel, of course. Fuller's a guy, too, is a filmmaker. He was never breaking the bank with his budgets on his films, right? He worked lean. He worked quick.
Yep.
But always really effective, right? Really, really effective with his films. And this one's got a really great opening, too. Like, it's fast. It's almost like this cold opening. And you know what's cool? You didn't see this a lot back then. Lots of quick cuts. The camera's moving. The angles that it uses are, you know, a lot more diversity than you tended to get, like these kind of static shots that you would get with a lot of Westerns back then. This is 1957, really ahead of its time technically.
Yes, indeed. And not only that, but in some ways we kind of talked about this a little bit politically, right? I mean, you got the strong woman here. Now, yeah, it does get into, you know, you could argue that it starts out as a strong woman story and then it kind of turns into a man saves the day story. So there are those elements to it. But again, I think that's the era that the movie's made in. But you definitely get the vibe that he's a big proponent of the strong female character with the Barbara Stanwyck character. And of course, she's a very strong actress with a very interesting face, and she can pull that off very well. I think the weirdest thing about this movie and watching it this time for me was it's interesting. The concept of the female rancher running the territory with the 40 gunmen, it's a pretty great concept, but you never really, you know, as much as that could be like in an Italian cinema, that would be like, you know, there'd be a gunman checking off 40 gunmen. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
This one, the 40 gunmen are not really, once they're established and everything else, there's really only one gunman they kind of take out of the 40. Well, maybe two if you count the brother. And they kind of leave it at that. It's really a small story kind of caught up in this. What I think when you sit down to watch the film, you think, well, Barry Sullivan and his brothers are going to take down all 40 gunmen. But that's not the case. There's really only two gunmen they take out, really, in a lot of ways. So it's interesting in that way. And it was kind of weird watching it this time. I don't know why, but I thought there was more shootouts and stuff, but it's really much more of a family drama in a weird way.
So I want to say this too. So this is streaming on Criterion. It's also streaming on Tubi and Plex for those that don't have Criterion. I'll tell you what, the premise for this film, like that plot, showdown in Arizona between the Bunnell brothers, U.S. Marshals, and Jessica Drum and the Iron Fist Rancher who controls the territory, that's a bit of a Trojan horse. And Fuller was always a subversive filmmaker. And to me, he's more interested in the human piece and the relationships. And I'll be honest, the big thing I love, like one of the big takeaway for me with this film is he, not to ever to the detriment of the film or never slowing it down, he's kind of demystifies or humanizes the mythos of the macho male on the frontier.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Like these men, they're stoic and they're tough, but he also shows their weaknesses. He shows their loves, their fears. There's a lot more emotional complexity here and sort of the dynamics of love than you would ever get in a lot of the Westerns of the era.
Right. It does tackle, and it's kind of early in the era. I can't remember when Liberty Valance came out, but which we talked about a long time ago, but
oh yeah.
You know, it does tackle the idea of the gunman being a thing of the past.
It even says it very overtly in this film that, like, he says, I feel, what does he say? He says, basically, that he's a dinosaur. Like, he is, mm-hmm. What he is coming to an end.
Yeah, and he's trying to teach his brothers to not become what he is. So I think the middle brother, the Gene Barry character, is probably too far gone, but they're trying to protect the young brother.
Which is, yeah, that's a device you see in films sometimes, but that's great. That gives us a really great homoerotic scene.
It does.
I have to say intentionally homoerotic, knowing Fuller.
Probably, yeah. I mean, I got to say, I don't know that I've ever had my brother rub my back so vigorously.
It's amazing because the younger brother's lying face down on the bed. Yeah. Their brother's sitting on the edge, but the other brother's on top of the younger brother, rubbing his bare back very vigorously for a long time. Yeah. And you get lines in that scene like, "I feel like a third leg," or "I'm a freak, Chico."
Yeah, totally Sam Fuller type dialogue.
Yeah, he loves that pulpy, subversive dialogue. Yeah. And that scene, you know, I had to kind of smile because I do think it's Fuller being, he's subverting that sort of overt masculinity. But he does that time and time again in this film. And I love it because Stanwyck's perfectly cast. She's such a strong presence in film. And let's give her flowers here. 49 years old, mm-hmm. Her stunt woman does not want to be dragged through the dirt by a horse, by her leg. Stanwyck goes, "Fuck it, I'll do it."
And does it. And does it.
She does it.
And you can clearly see it's Barbara Stanwyck. It's pretty amazing.
Yeah, let's give her flowers for that. That's a pretty impressive stunt. I don't know if at my age I'd be too keen to do that.
Well, I'm 50, and that's only 1 year removed from her age here, and I can tell you right now, I wouldn't do it. Even if they undercranked the camera, I still think that's an impressive stunt for a 49-year-old Hollywood starlet to do. Now, of course, she's on the downturn of her Hollywood stardom. Again, this is like one of, I think, last two or three films she actually made. I think she made mostly television movies, or she was on TV pretty much for the remainder of her career. So this is really kind of like a last hurrah for her in some ways. So I don't know if she was just, you know, being the professional she is, or if she's just like, you know what, I need to find a way to make people see that I'm business or whatever. But either way, it's super impressive that, you know, we get a Jackie Chan moment in a Sam Fuller movie in 1957.
What's wild about that is even though she was 49, she probably physically was 69 because this was 1957.
Yeah.
Booze and cigarettes and pills and red meat. You know, she was probably 69 and she's getting dragged by that horse, man. It's like, yeah, she's somewhere Michelle Yeoh smiles at her.
Yes.
Right. Like, she's just incredible. But I think that she's always been very professional from everything I've read, like a consummate pro. And I think that speaks to Fuller's faith in her and her faith in Fuller. Mm-hmm. Right. Which is, I thought is really cool. So that we get that opening and I want to talk about that. There's a really great shot where it's underneath the wagon at the horse's legs.
Yeah.
See, it's just really cool. And the camera work in this is really ahead of its time.
It is.
Like you said, Stanwyck being sort of, it's almost like Johnny Guitar in a way. Like, not quite the same, but this and Johnny Guitar make a good double.
I think so. Yeah, I think so. I think they work really well together. Yeah, actually. Yeah.
You know, you get, Joan Crawford, Barbara Stanwyck. And it's funny, the Jidge Carroll stuff, like I like that song High Riding Woman that he does early on. It almost feels like a Dean Martin Rio Bravo kind of piece. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You know, it's good. But the other thing about this film, we've kind of talked about how it deconstructs or really, I think, looks at an honest look at masculinity and the humanity in men that were larger than life on the screen and maybe what they wanted to portray or project. But the violence in this is really kind of shocking. There's a really shocking early death scene that propels Griff and his brothers into a role in the town.
Right.
It's a pretty shocking scene. I mean, I got to say, they set it up really well. Fuller sets it up really well to make it seem tragic and shocking.
Yeah, I don't want to mention the character actor's name because it'll give away a thing, but it's a character actor that I quite enjoy.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. Good little turn. But again, Fuller gets that you know, that 5-10 minutes of screen time and really maximizes the emotional output we get. Some of the little touches I love, you know, when I love the look of the Bunnell brothers wearing those black suits with those the Colonel Sanders ties, man. The
yeah.
What are they again? What's the name of them? Not Bolo Ties.
I don't know what the name of them is.
You know if we see Colonel Sanders. Yeah. They look great in them, but I love when there's scenes when they're standing around and there's dust and dirt on these black suits.
Yeah, like they can get clean, but they can never get clean enough. Matter of fact, there's two bathing scenes. Maybe three.
Oh, yeah.
And so they, you know, it's almost like they can never get clean enough.
That's right. But that feels very real to me. And it's something you don't always see in films, these little touches you get from Fuller. You know who I liked in this film? And it's not really about her. But again, I think it speaks to Fuller's knack for creating humanity and characters, even in small parts. Is I love Eve Brent's turn as Lavinia Spanger, the gunsmith.
Oh, yeah.
She's really cute. And I really like her character. You know, I could have almost had more of her in the film.
Yeah, there's more. There's an economy there, right? I mean, you get a lot from her. I mean, her character's not deep in the movie.
No.
But you get a lot from the scenes Fuller gives her. And yeah, for that matter, you get a lot from Gene Barry as well and the way that Fuller sets him up.
Oh, big time. And I think the Bunnell brothers, especially Gene Barry and Barry Sullivan, like they look like they could pass for brothers. There's times where I'm on the phone going, hang on, who's that? Is that him or the other one?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, they really look alike. But I love the scene they give Eve Brent and Gene Barry, when he goes, I've never kissed a gunsmith before. And it's her, and he goes, and she goes, any recoil?
Yeah, that's such a Sam Fuller line right there.
Totally, man.
Such a Sam Fuller line. You know, it's like, I never kissed a person from Maryland before. Yeah. Any crabs? You know, I mean, it's just something like he would write. You know, he just, that's the kind of writer he was. So
absolutely
pulpy and just very direct. And it can be seen as kind of cheesy in hindsight, right? But it's almost like noir. It's almost like noir dialogue.
Be playful.
Yeah.
I love the scene. This is just testament to Stanwyck's power as an actress. I love the scene when she's at the table with all the men.
Yeah.
She holds the room.
Yeah.
Without question, she holds the room. Great use of shadows in that scene. Just really testament to her.
I think, you know, the interesting thing about this film, watching it now, is how much sexual undertone there is in this movie in 1957.
Big time.
Like, this movie's got a lot of sex in it. There's not any sexual scenes, but everybody is, it's almost like everybody underneath it all is wanting to get laid.
Yeah. There's very much that sexual tension.
Yeah, and it's very interesting to me. It really is. I really quite enjoyed that and was kind of surprised. I was really surprised.
But in hindsight, we shouldn't be, right? It's Fuller.
Yeah.
But you're right. At the time, it's like, wow, because everything was very buttoned up, mm-hmm, with a lot of the films from the time, right?
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, no, it's good. It's funny. I can't help but think, I'm watching this, and I'm watching the brothers Bunnell in their suits, and I'm looking at Barry Sullivan and Gene Barry, and I'm like, man, these dudes look like the uncles of Robert Forrester. Yeah. I couldn't help but think of Robert Forrester, man. But yeah, camera works great. I love when the camera near the back end of the film, so that storm, I don't want to spend too much time talking about it. That windstorm is pretty impressive. I think some of that might have been movie effects, but some of it also looked like they were blowing fans, and there's tumbleweeds blowing around. And
oh, I'm sure they were blowing big fans, no doubt.
I mean, that would have been a hard scene to film.
Yeah, no doubt.
Riding a horse in the dirt like that. But I love when the camera, it's almost like a panaglide. Like it pulls through the town with the two brothers when they're going to go in that alley and deal with something. I love the, I guess the camera work. That's awesome. Charlie is who they're looking for.
Yeah.
But this, we get one hell of a bump from an actor falling from a window.
Oh, yeah, yeah. No, it's a good one. They just do that thing where they put that's what the Asian cinema would do. They put extra sawdust or whatever down over top of maybe a small pad or something. But, yeah, it's a pretty good fall.
It is a good fall. Single take, no cuts. Really good. One of the things late in the film really impressed me, really kind of moved me in a way, and really cemented what I thought about the film was a pretty earnest conversation about kind of feelings and men, like a man's feelings. And, you know, there's kind of a spurned love. And there's a pretty tragic reveal in that scene. And that's not something you had a lot, especially in a Western where it was very buttoned up and very stoic. But there's a very tragic decision made by a spurned lover here. And it was very, very surprising for the time.
It was. It was. I mean, there's some good stuff in here. I mean, he plays, he throws a curveball at you too with the wedding sequence. You think you're going into one type of wedding, you're going into another.
Yeah.
Then he throws another curveball. But it's very much, you know what I really realized watching it this time? I never really put two and two together, but I'd say that Kurt Russell and George Cosmatos' Tombstone is very inspired by this movie.
Very much, right down to the suits.
Right down to the suits, yeah. I mean, I've got a lot of Tombstone, and this tells a Tombstone story, and, you know, I don't know which one I like more. I think I probably like this a little bit more than Tombstone, but that's just because I think Tombstone's, I love Tombstone, but it's a very bloated movie.
It is.
This one doesn't, I mean, this one is so lean and so quick to get its story told. It's really kind of an amazing kind of virtuoso storytelling mechanism that he just moves it along, develops these characters quickly. You might hear a dog whining in the background. I got my niece's dog with me right now. Yeah, so I want to apologize to listeners right now. He's a very needy little guy. Not a little guy, he's a big guy. But I like the simplicity of that storytelling. And, you know, you get all the romance, you get all that stuff, and he's able to put, you know, movie tricks in there where, you know, he's giving you red herrings, he's doing this, he's doing that. It's great. He even has horror tropes in here. Scene with hanging legs and stuff like that. I mean, it's almost like he throws every genre into this Western.
Yeah, he does. Yeah, he does. Speaking of amazing, we need those wooden barrel bubble bats at the GGTMC compound.
Yes. Yes. Now, who's in charge of hot water there?
Tom. He's going to keep them hot. Further down the block you went, the hotter they got.
I love how quick you were to answer with Zom on that one.
He's gonna have that wooden ladle going, man. Yeah.
Oh, we love you, John.
Yeah, he's got to get back on the show, man.
Yeah, we gotta get him back on.
I love the beautiful blacks at the funeral.
Oh yeah.
And the black horse, the beautiful ornate black carriage. God, it looks so good in this black one looks so good. And I don't want to spoil too much, but the back end, there's a really wild kind of cold business decision made at the shootout.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. I love the shootout. So Barry Sullivan is so effortlessly cool in this movie.
Yeah, he is.
Oh, man. What a cool fucking move at the end of this movie.
Yeah.
I don't want to give it away. But the thing he says, and he just keeps walking. What a fucking badass this guy is.
It's true, and it's stoic, but it always feels like he feels very conflicted.
Yeah, it borders on being cheesy. It's right there. It's right there, man. It borders on being like, you know, just almost a touch too much.
Yeah.
But it works, and I just smiled. I just smiled. I loved it so much. And the line, I can't say the line of dialogue because it's a spoiler as well, but what he says as he's walking by, and people are just looking at him like, this guy is the fucking shit. Oh,
good time.
He is the baddest gunfighter that has ever lived. He's really so good in this movie. As a matter of fact, he was almost my MVP for this movie because I don't know if I could give it to him again. I want to say I do, but I don't know if I ever really noticed how much I like Barry Sullivan's face. It's an interesting face. It's not, it's almost Bronson-like in a weird way.
That's what I mean. Like, but that's the thing. I've always thought that young Robert Forster looked a little bit Bronson-y.
And he does. Yeah. Bronson, Forster, kind of a mix of the two really in a way. Yeah. Right.
Yeah.
And, I don't know, man. I never really kind of pictured him as that kind of actor. But this movie reminded me that, you know, he could be a badass. And if cast right, he could be a real badass.
That's the thing. you know, that's the thing. It's there's a certain nuance to what Fuller gives him, and that he gives Sullivan, and that Sullivan runs with. Mm-hmm. That's really effective.
Yep, definitely.
Those are all my notes.
I don't have a whole lot more to add. I think this is just a right down the middle, very well done genre movie. This is Sam Fuller doing what Sam Fuller does. And he takes very simple stories and makes them complex with character choices and cinematography. And this is just a great example of a very well-made movie. It's not going to, I don't think it, I don't, I, well, you know what? I think for some people, it might knock their socks off. They may not think they're getting this from a classic Western, but this movie is very, it's got that swagger of like a, you know, the kind of 70s exploitation cinema we liked, where the badass kung fu lead or the badass blaxploitation lead or the badass spaghetti Western lead. It's kind of got that in a weird way, kind of mixed in with the badass female and some good stunt work, some awesome cinematography, which is where my MVT is probably going to end up leaning. And, you know, just great sequences. I don't think there's a lot of movies we can say we review that there are not wasted sequences in. I don't think there's any wasted sequences in this movie. I think it pretty much establishes everything in the opening. And then, you know, it sets up our three leads in town and what their scruples are going to be and what they're going to be dealing with. It moves into a bit of a romantic angle. And then it climaxes, and it climaxes well, even better than David Lopan. So the truth is, this is another great example of how you kind of like the Warriors, how you take a, I don't think it's as great as the Warriors, but I don't know if it's a masterpiece. I think it's a very, very good film. Arguably a great film. I could see it being arguably a great Western for some people. I don't know if it's there for me. I think I need a few more watches to kind of get there. But, man, I really enjoyed rewatch watching it again. All the sexual undertones that are there. Like I said, the simplicity. The idea of using the camera almost as a character in spots here. That's pretty great. That's kind of a film noirish type thing. And, you know, the dialogue, like you said. I mean, it's very simple, but it all makes sense. And these guys, you know, these three brothers, you know, again, Tombstone, very inspired. These three brothers, they want to hang it up. They want to move to a town. They want to be, they don't really want to be involved, but they end up their hands end up getting forced and they end up being involved. So it's a lot of fun in that way. And, I mean, what a movie, what an old school movie. I mean, we're talking about a movie that's, geez, how old is this now? It's up there.
Say almost 65, almost 70 years old, 67 years.
Yeah. I don't think you can go wrong. Cause like Will said, I mean, even if you think that old violence is a bit chaste in these movies, I think the violence in this is shocking. It's not overly gory or anything. Cause that wasn't what movies were at that time. But I think the violence here is shocking. It's abrupt. It's surprising. Like I said, we can't really talk about it because there's some things that happen with violence in this film that really shake the movie up like two or three times, really.
Yeah.
And you're kind of surprised by it. I think maybe one death I saw coming. There's two more that I kind of honestly didn't see coming. Even watching it again, and I've seen this before, but it's been a long time. So I really enjoyed this rewatch. And this is a good example of how good Sam Fuller was. And we got to do more Sam Fuller films. We definitely got to do more. I recommend this wholeheartedly for folks to check out. If you have the Criterion Channel, but if you don't, Tubi's a great example. I'm sure it looks good on there.
Sure it does.
The film looks amazing anyway. So I'll kick it over to you for MVTs or Make or Breaks.
So, yeah, I just want to give flowers to Fuller, man. You know what it feels like to me? And not to say they're necessarily the same film in terms of quality or anything else, but I want to mention Stanley Kubrick's The Killing. Because I feel like both films to me, it's the Trojan horse of a certain genre, be it sort of a noir or a Western. And you see the director's influence and insertion of things that works within the framework of the media, the genre, but also outside of it.
Right.
Things that sprinkling in, right? So that's kind of what it reminded me of in that sense. So make or break, I'm going to go with that emotional spurning scene with that really horrific, revelation.
Yeah.
Right. There's a sort of tragic humanity on display in that, which again, you did not get in Westerns. Mm-hmm. Since, you know, I was like, wow. And there's a few, like you said, a few scenes that are pretty violent, especially for almost a 70-year-old Western. MBT, I got to go Fuller. I could go with cinematography. I could go with Stanwyck. I could go with a few of the actors in it. But to me, Fuller's the guy that brings it all together, elevates this. And while we're talking about Fuller, one, you know, a Fuller I've seen, I love that isn't as well known, but it's pretty cool. It's The Crimson Kimono.
Oh yeah, yeah. You've talked about that one before.
Yeah. I really dig it, man. I remember seeing it, and it's kind of a love triangle noir with about two detectives, James Shigeta, Glenn Corbett, Victoria Shaw. So check that one out. But yeah, Fuller's the MVP for me. Scores a 7.5 out of 10. I really like this one. I can only see it going up, upon watches, because I'll be honest, I had to watch like 20 minutes of this, turn it off, come back to it.
Yeah. This is a grower. This is a film that I think people will look at over and over and over again, probably for the rest of time.
Oh yeah. The craftsmanship, it's just really good, man. Yeah. Really dig this one. I'm glad you picked it.
Yeah. This is a lot of fun. My MVT, I'm going to go with the cinematography here, because Barry Sullivan comes close. I really like him a lot, but I don't give it to cinematographers much. This is shot by Joseph Biroch, or maybe Baroche. I don't know how you say his last name, but he shot such things as Shanks, which we've covered, which come up again.
Back to Shanks.
Yeah. The Longest Yard, Blazing Saddles. I mean, Superman. This is a different Superman, 1973 Superman. Brian Song, Grissom Gang. I mean, all kinds of stuff. But not only that, but stuff like It's a Wonderful Life. I mean, the list goes on and on. This guy has shot some of the great American films of the last 100 years. And this film looks amazing. Like, it looks like it was shot yesterday.
It's really, really well shot.
And it's amazing how well it looks. So I have to give it to him. Man, so many great films he shot. I'm just looking at Hustle. He shot the Burt Reynolds film Hustle.
No.
Yeah, shot Airplane 2, the sequel. How about that? And The Jerk 2. Ouch.
Joseph Biroch. So shout out to Joseph Biroch, whose name doesn't get mentioned, I think, when we talk about great cinematographers. Yeah.
Emperor of the North. Body of work. Yeah, Emperor of the North, which is one I've always wanted to cover on the show. He shot that.
Oh, great film. Escape from Planet of the Apes.
Yeah, Hush, Hush, Sweet Sorrow, Charlotte. He shot that.
Man.
Viva Las Vegas. There you go.
Wow. He's legit. Yeah, too legit to quit.
Too legit to quit. So I'm going to give it to him this time around. That's not to take away from Barry Sullivan or The Bat. Ew, me and Todd covered The Bat. Oh, I didn't know he shot that. Holy shit. That's like early, like 1959, like Giallo-inspired horror film.
Wow.
Wow. Crazy. I didn't even know he shot that. Damn. Anyway. But yeah, again, not to take away from Barry Sullivan or Sam Fuller. But I'm going to give it to Joseph Biroch. My favorite scene in the film, oddly, is a little moment, but it's a moment I like a lot. You know the scene where Sullivan's coming in to arrest somebody in the alleyway?
Yeah.
And then his little brother gets involved. And I love that there's a simple line of dialogue, like, now you've killed a man. Because he wanted so much more for his baby brother. And now he knows there's probably no coming back. You know, because his baby brother feels empowered by it. You can see it in his face. Like, he's so proud of himself. And he doesn't want that for his baby brother. So I found that to be a very powerful moment. I like that quite a bit. So I'm going to go with that moment. My score is the same as yours, 7.5, but I could see this being easily in the 8 to 9 territory, like all time. Like this is like going back and watching this now. Like this is quickly becoming one of my favorite older Westerns. Like it's really good.
It is. Like you said, it's a grower, not a shower.
Yeah. Oh man. It's, I cannot recommend people check this out enough. Let's put it that way. All right. So, again, you can watch it on Tubi, the Criterion channel. Plex has it. It's out there. Check it out. I think Criterion did put a physical release out, a Blu-ray. So, I think it's out there. I don't think it's out in 4K, but I wouldn't be surprised if they didn't release this in 4K at some point. If you're into the, if you have to have that 4K action, it might happen. Next week, Will, what are we doing next week for episode 666?
Well, we went back and forth, man. You and I behind the curtain.
A lot of satanic stuff out there.
A lot of satanic stuff. You know, should we go from the country? Should we go new? Should we go old? We've covered some of the heavy hitters already. I was even thinking about doing Hellraiser.
Yeah.
You know, but in the end, I like to go deep in the mind sometimes, try to find a diamond in the rough. And, you know, you take a risk. And we're going to cover one that I'd seen on the shelves for so long, man. And it just never got around to it. It's 1988's Camilo Villa film, The Unholy.
Yes. Now, you might be saying to yourself, why are you guys doing that? And, you know, well, we're always looking for stuff like that. But I'm just going to give you guys a bit of a preview. I'm glad we did The Unholy. And that's what I'll say. I think you're going to have some fun talking about that one.
Oh, we are. Oh, we are.
I think we're going to have some
fun. I have a screenshot to send you and our special guest. I've been saving on my phone.
So we'll have fun talking about that. And again, good friend of the show, Jose, will be on the show. I'm actually in communication with him right now as I'm recording this and trying to convince him to use Skype instead of using Zoom so we can just add him on Skype. Because we're so old school, we still use Skype, folks. Not only do we use the original mixer and the original mic, we use Skype still.
Original software.
we just refuse to change. I will not change until my hand is forced. Like Barry Sullivan in 40 Guns, baby. You heard us talk about Caliber 9 from Outer Space. Check out that podcast. I won't add it to our roll call just quite yet, but definitely check those guys out. Give them a shout out. And everything, but check out Not a Bomb, Watch Get Plus, I believe is coming back pretty soon. Married with Clickers, Chinstroker versus Punter, The Feminine Critique, See Here Podcast, love that album. One day I'll write all this down. I never will. Let's be honest with you. At this point, it'll never happen. So it's kind of fun watching me bumble through everything. Raiders of the Podcast, there we go.
There you go.
And I probably forgot somebody along the way. I apologize. Night of the Living Podcast. There we go. I'll probably remember somebody as soon as I say the words adios. But anyway, we want to thank everybody for listening. Tune in next week for episode 666, and I will say adios.
Adios.
Thanks for listening. You can find the gentleman at ggtmc.com, and you can email the gentleman at midnightcinema@gmail.com. We'll be right back.